What applause, live applause. Yeah, would you mind moving your mic stage right for me? Thank you so much. I don't have any hand sanitizer with me, and we're being very cautious here. That's why I asked Rina to move, because when we have a singer, we have what we call a spit zone. We wanted Rina to get out of the spit zone. So there you go. You appreciate that, right? Ah. That's a t-shirt, right? Yeah, get out of the spit zone. Oh, I should take my mask off, because I'm on stage and I get to take my mask off. Yay! Okay. All right, so today I'm talking about inhabiting uncertainty. Why am I talking about inhabiting uncertainty? Certainly life has been unfolding according to plan recently, hasn't it? Not so much. Did anybody see this pandemic coming? I didn't even know the word. I mean, I'd heard of it, you know, when you talk about like the Spanish flu or the bubonic plague or what have you, but the word pandemic never crossed my mind until whenever this started, March or whatever it was, February. And so there's that, and we don't really know what the repercussions of it are, you know, and really, it's one of those things where we humans, you know, we want everything to be certain. We want to think that we have control. And so we're like, okay, the pandemic's here. We're going to do what we need to do. We did it. Now that's fixed. Great. Let's move on. Not so much. You know, we seem to be having more complications and more numbers, and we don't really know where it's going to go. You know, the another reason for talking about this idea about inhabiting uncertainty is all of the stuff that's going on with race relations in this country. You know, again, it's one of those human things. I was watching a video by Bryan Stevenson, who's the guy that this movie Just Mercy is about. He deals with incarcerated black people, particularly young kids that are given adult sentences. And he was talking about how in the civil rights movement, you know, we got black people the right to vote, equal rights, Jim Crow gone, all that stuff. And when it happened, it's like, great, we fixed that, didn't we? Not so much. No, there's still stuff that needs to be done, still inequities and still challenges that we're facing on a day-to-day basis that are coming to the surface, which is a beautiful thing. But again, it's that human thing of like, well, we fixed it and now we can move on. Not necessarily. You know, it said in the reading, life is uncertainty, and there is a vast amount of uncertainty for us to cope with on a moment-by-moment basis. And honestly, you know, some of us may like uncertainty because it feels like something new is coming or new possibility is going to happen, but then we get uncertainty that's a little too much uncertainty for us, right? Some outcome, whether it's personal or global, that we're really afraid is going to happen. And so we try and we bump up against it and we try and control it and we pretend, I think as the reading said, that that everything should be under our control and everything should be certain. But in reality, we're fighting against something that is not true when we do that. So today, I'm going to talk a little bit about the principles of uncertainty, what it looks like, what people say about it. And I'll talk a bit about some of our ineffective coping strategies, and then talk about a way perhaps that we can cope with uncertainty or inhabit uncertainty in a way that it actually opens up greater possibilities for us, in a way that is productive and kind to ourselves, but also kind to the world. Because if we're not battling uncertainty all the time, I think we're going to be more present and more available to be that vessel of goodness that I know everybody sitting here in this sanctuary and everybody watching this at home longs to be. And is already to a certain extent, but like I said several weeks ago, I just want to be better, and I think we all want to be better. We all want to continue to grow and be that place where spirit can show up and be a healing light into the world. So when I talk about uncertainty, first I want to talk about our opinion about uncertainty. And our opinion of uncertainty, I think, is what I just said. It's like it's okay to a certain point, but sometimes when it crosses that line, we say, this shouldn't be happening to me, if we even know that we're wrestling with uncertainty. There is a huge element of denial and uncertainty. We feel badly, we feel angry, we feel hurt, we feel betrayed, we feel disappointed, and if we really look at that, We can see that we had an expectation that life or another person or a situation was supposed to be a way that we thought it should be, and now it isn't, and now we're feeling that sting of uncertainty and wanting to control it. The way that we tend to control it, the way that we tend to manage uncertainty is through A, denying that it exists at all, denying that uncertainty is a normal part of life, denying that the illusion of certainty is an illusion. And then there's other helpful things that we do, things such as addictions, right, to cope with uncertainty. I would say drinking, food, drugs, alcohol, sex, shopping, gambling. Now, those are just some of mine. No, I'm kidding. Perhaps others have addictions they'd like to call out. Hi, my name is Bonnie, and I'm a sugaraholic. And let's don't talk about television and Candy Crush, okay? Yeah, so that all of that stuff, all of those things are forms of addiction. But what I'm really struck with as well is Richard Rohr. You know, when Richard Rohr talks about addiction a lot, he worked in recovery quite a bit. Richard Rohr is up there. I don't know whether Brian's able to get all of these pictures, but Richard Rohr is in the what we call the flat choir. He's sitting next to Mr. Rogers behind a scary-looking Bill in a bunny costume. And sorry, Bill. Anyway, you know, there's the addiction of thought. We're addiction to our own thought, to our own patterns of thinking, and we think that our thought is true. We think that our thought is reality, and we think that our thought is the only way to think. So when thoughts that are different than ours come up, we tend to grip to our thought, to cling to our thought, and to push back and become defensive, or then think that that other person's thought is the only way to think, and then we shrink, and we become, we shut down in response to somebody's thought that is different than us. But they just think their thought is the reality, just as we think our thought is the reality. So this shows up in so many ways in life. You know, certainly in the whole battle between what's going on with the COVID situation, you know, that should we shelter at home? Should we get back to work? Should we wear masks? Should we not wear masks? We all think that our opinion is right. And I don't really know what's right. I'm going with what the government says and that we made an agreement with the government to social distance and wear masks if we got back together again. And to me, that seems like erring on the side of caution, which I stand for. But there are people that have equally adamant opinions about the other end of that spectrum. And then there's, you know, the idea of the thing that we're struggling with now, too, in terms of racism. People think that their opinions about racism are true. You know, and I've been saying every week, and it's so hard to say this in a way that people can hear, so I'm going to try again, because I'm not always saying it in the right way that people can hear. But, you know, racism is real. Racism is happening. Systemic racism is happening, but it is based on a made-up construct that some people are less than because of the color of their skin. That part of it is completely made up. You know, I was listening to a podcast about Ruby Bridges recently, and she was one of the first children that was integrated in the South. She went to an elementary school, a white elementary school, when she was 6 years old. She was supposed to go with two other black children, and they backed out at the last minute. So when she arrived, there were U.S. Marshals there to escort her in, and there was an angry mob of people shouting at the six-year-old girl and shaking their fists at her and hanging up signs and banners, and it felt so hateful to everybody around. And Ruby said that her frame of reference, because it was in Louisiana, her frame of reference was Mardi Gras. And so she said to herself, wow, this is a really strange Mardi Gras celebration. But she knew that something was wrong. It said in her podcast that she started to skip because she never walked very far without throwing a skip in there. And then she just stopped and she's like, no, this is different. I have to be quiet. I have to be still. I can't make any sudden moves. When she went into the school, she was met by her teacher. She was the only student in her class because none of the other teachers would teach her. Again, something that they made up that they thought was true, some opinion that they were addicted to, that they couldn't bear to teach this beautiful little black child, you know? And other teachers quit even because she was going to be there. it's so contrived and so made up, and yet people take it so seriously. I sometimes wonder if, you know, I'm digressing a little bit, but I've been thinking a lot about racism and whatnot in terms of projected shame, and I haven't found out a lot about that. I want to do more research on that, but I do wonder if the whoever seems to be in power needs a scapegoat and they need to project their shame onto somebody and make the other bad so that I can feel better. And again, another thought addiction and another addiction to not looking at the discomfort, the groundlessness, that feeling shame causes us to feel, that uncertainty. I'll feel much more certain if I polarize, if I make somebody wrong. I'll feel much more certain if I hate somebody. I've got to get over that, people. You know, and I'm not saying it's them and us. I think we're all doing it. We're all doing it to a certain extent. We're all making the other the scapegoat, and we're all projecting our own feelings of inadequacy and shame, and also our need to be right and our need to feel secure. You know, another thought addiction is this polarization of ideologies, whether it's political or religious, is that we need to cling to something to make us feel secure. And what if we were better served by uncertainty? I was thinking about this clinging to ideologies, and I thought I'd rather than do anything completely, you know, politically disruptive that's likely to cause a bunch of conversations that I don't want to have, basically. I really strive for neutrality, and but what I thought about was, that I love animals, and I in the past have been somewhat of an animal rights activist, and I don't eat meat, but so I'm kind of dissing my own people when I say this. But there are I have read stories about vegetarians that have issued death threats because they so want people to be vegetarians and they hate people who aren't. Does that make sense? It's kind of like pro-life people making death threats to anti-abortion or to abortion doctors, you know? Same principle. The other thing, when I lived in New York, it was in an era, I don't know if they still do this, but when women would wear fur coats on the street, people from animal rights institutions would throw blood on them. Doesn't make sense to me. First of all, where are you getting the blood? You know, that's where I go with that. And it doesn't seem to achieve anything other than reinforcing the principle of I am right and you are wrong. I am good and you are bad. You are activating my shame. You are activating my terror, so I'm going to act like a terrorist, right? Now, if you do want to talk to me after the service about all of that, that is fine. And really, I am hopefully able to hold any conversation, so bring it on, babies. So, anyway, enough about that. What my point is that in order to avoid the feeling of uncertainty, we get hooked onto a certain thought and we call it reality. Now, who among us here and at home has not done that? Raise your hand and stand up if that's true for you, so that we may worship you and fall at your feet. Oddly, I do not see anybody standing. Strange. Okay. So how do we get out of this vicious cycle? Because it is a cycle. We fix it. We do it once, and then we think, just like I was saying about racism and COVID, okay, I did that. I meditated. I'm good to go, right? Not so much. Life gives us many opportunities. Well, one of the first things, I think, is to be honest about the nature of existence. Hugh did such a beautiful job with that reading where they talked about that existence is uncertainty. It is impermanence, and that is the nature of existence. Everything allegedly dies. Everything recycles. Everything dies and is resurrected and born again, but we don't necessarily focus on that part of it. We focus on the fact that everything dies, and that stresses us out. Everything is changing all of the time. We are changing all of the time. And rather than resist that reality, why not just accept it and make peace with it, inhabit it in a certain way? in a way that serves not only us, but that serves the entire world. I was reading Pema Chodron as I was gathering information for this message, and Pema Chodron reminded me of a wonderful TED Talk, and she wrote a book also that you all may have seen. It's the woman who had the stroke, Jill Bolte Taylor, I'm not sure how you say her name, but it was called My Stroke of Insight. And she talked about the brain and how the brain functions and how, you know, so many, if you're using one side of your brain versus the other, if one side of your brain is deactivated, your life is completely different. But one of the things that she said that was particularly relevant to this idea of uncertainty was that she talked about how every emotion is an automatic response and it lasts for about 90 seconds. And then anything after 90 seconds is us applying a story or revitalizing that emotion or rekindling it in some way so that we can continue to feel that sense of agitation and control and avoiding the feeling of uncertainty. What Pema Chodron suggests instead is to acknowledge that we are feeling something, whether it's shame or anger or generalized discomfort that we can't name, anxiety, fear, hatred, and just feel the feeling and know that it's going to last for 90 seconds. And then we breathe into it for 90 seconds or so. And as we breathe into it, we start to see that it kind of dissipates a bit. And then we see ourselves as we try and pick it up again and rev it up again, right? We try and apply a level of story. What Rupert Spira says to do, he suggests that we separate the sensation from the story. We feel the sensation of the emotion, of the condition in our body, and then we notice where the story leaps in, and we just gently part them. And recognize that the story is what I was talking about before. It is our thought about something. And our thought about something is not reality. Reality is that life just is, impermanence just is, and we are constantly imposing our opinion or our story upon life to try and define it so that it seems more manageable. And the truth is that it is actually more manageable and more pleasant and more expansive and more possible if we let go of that practice of imposing our definitions on life. Now, it's easier said than done. And I reassure you that you will probably need to do this more than once. More than once. Life provides us with many, many, many opportunities. But the thing to do, the thing that I'm trying to remember to do, and I hope you all practice this with me, is when I start feeling myself getting agitated, is just to, oh, wait, I'm getting agitated. This is a great sign. This is a signpost that I can go inside and do the spiritual work. And so turn within. Just feel that agitation. Say, wow, this is a great 90-second little fantasy trip into my weirdness, you know, my humanity, and let me just feel this. Wow, emotions, yeah. Oh, and here comes the story. This is why I'm feeling this way. This is the story that I'm telling myself. Whew. And then let it go. Let it go. Float into the native nothingness from where it came. And then go about our day. See if we feel lighter. See if we pick it up again. And then do it again. Probably get an opportunity to do that, I don't know, like 100 times a day, you know? In my world, I think, get to do that a lot. So it's a beautiful thing. And I'm going to read this quote where she talks about how the benefit of doing this. Pema Chodron says, instead of thinking of feelings as bad, we could think of them as road signs or barometers that tell us we're in touch with groundlessness, another word for impermanence or uncertainty. Then we would see the feelings for what they really are, the gateway to liberation, an open door to freedom from suffering, the path to our deepest well-being and joy. We have a choice. We can spend our whole life suffering because we can't relax with how things really are, or we can relax and embrace the open-endedness of the human situation, which is fresh, unfixated, and unbiased. Pema Chodron. Now, the mistake that some people make with this type of information about I'm just supposed to feel my feelings and that's it, you know, I get to be all relaxed and calm and I'll get it someday and blah, 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 you know, sometimes that leads to a certain extent of complacency and feeling like we don't need to go out and make a difference in the world. And really, the opposite is true. I think, in my experience, when I do more of this spiritual work of teasing out my story from my sensations and feeling deeper into humanity and feeling a deeper sense of compassion, I want to do more. I want to serve more. And I wonder if that's true for anybody else here or anybody in the Facebook audience or the YouTube group. You know, there's something about letting go and becoming more present that brings forth the issue of kindness and service and wanting to establish something beautiful, the kingdom of heaven here on earth. I looked for an example of this in life, and gosh, there are so many. But the one that really drew me this week, it's because of a lot of things I was working with this week. I read so many articles this week about various things about you know, the conditions of the world and trying to get a deeper understanding of what's really going on and from a spiritual perspective. But I think I needed a break from all of that heavy stuff. And so I watched the Mr. Rogers movie, Won't You Be My Neighbor? The documentary about Mr. Rogers, who is right back there behind me in his red sweater. When they excavate this church someday in 300 years, when we're covered in rubble, that is, unless Norm is around for that long, he'll keep it going. he won't let it fall down. But, you know, let's say Mr. Rogers is the only one who survives. They'll be like, oh, this church worshipped a man in a red sweater. Wow. Who was that mighty man? And the reason I think that I was drawn to him is that he was so ordinary. I mean, have you all seen his TV show? I didn't watch it as a kid. It was a little before my time, given that I'm in my 60s. But I did watch it when I was babysitting, when I would babysit for kids. And in the documentary, it said, you know, this was such an anomaly because you make a list of everything that is bad television, okay? Cheap production values, cheap set, cheap costumes, not a really charismatic kind of guy, a really slow pace, many other things, music that was different, and yet it worked. It worked. Mr. Rogers changed lives, one child at a time. And they said that when this radio station wanted to have him come and do an event, the person who owned the radio station was like, really, that guy? That guy? Are you serious? Have you seen his show? And he came, and they were lining up around the block with children waiting to see him. And the kids would come in front of him one at a time, and he'd say something like, I like you just the way you are. How powerful is that? And yet how simple is that? And I know he did the work to get to that place. He did not have an easy childhood, but he cleared his heart and he opened up his heart to be that place of kindness, somebody that influenced the lives of, I don't know how many children, influenced generations of children and their families and their parents. So what I say about Mr. Rogers is that he empowered kindness. He brought power to kindness. But the thing about him, too, is that he didn't stop there. He also brought kindness to power. Mr. Rogers was a revolutionary, a very quiet, understated revolutionary. There's a scene in this movie, in the Mr. Rogers movie, Won't You Be My Neighbor, there's a scene where there was an incident during the 60s, early 70s, where there were black children in a swimming pool, and the white owners of the pool threw all of these chemicals in the pool, and everybody had to get out. Now, what that meant, of course, is that the white people couldn't use the pool either, which is one of the points of racism. Hello, it's like, you know, I'm with Kendi, Ibram X. Kendi, who says, you know, if we solve this racial divide, it's going to be better for everybody. And I, you know, I've always felt that my innate selfishness was helping me move past racial judgment, because I used to always think, you know, let's take, you know, gay people. I lived in New York when AIDS was a really big deal, when it was first starting out, and caring for AIDS folks in the hospital, people with AIDS. And I was just thinking, you know, why are we scorning these people? What if a cure for something that affects me is in the brain of one of these people? And I think about Vivian Thomas, who was one of the first heart surgeons, but he couldn't really be a surgeon because he was black, but he did all the work, and the surgeon got all the credit until later on when he was awarded an honorary doctorate. So if we are putting down a race, it's bad for everybody. It's bad for us. And that may not be the reason to do it. It's probably a higher calling to do it, because it's the right thing to do. It's the right thing for everybody. But if you're stuck, if anybody's stuck, there is that thing of, you know, this is going to benefit you too. So get on the stick, people. Anyway, so back to Mr. Rogers. They threw the chemicals in the pool. Everybody had to get out of the pool. And then shortly thereafter on his TV show, Mr. Rogers had his black postman come, no, back black police officer, another brilliant, subtle technique, came, and Mr. Rogers had his feet in this little plastic pool, and he said he was cooling down his feet because it was hot, and he asked the black police officer, "Would you like to put your feet in the pool with me?" And the black police officer said, "Well, you know, I think I would." And they sat there with their feet in the pool together. And nobody made a big deal about it, but I'm going to trust that it had an impact. The black police officer was also gay, and there's a whole story about that in the movie too, but I encourage you to watch it. One more thing about bringing power to kindness in terms of Mr. Rogers. I'm a little obsessed with him this morning. I just saw the movie, you know. And this is kind of a spoiler. This is kind of a spoiler, but I'm going to tell you anyway because it's so good. So Mr. Rogers is changing the lives of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of children with his television show, and the government wants to cut the funding for PBS. And so Mr. Rogers has to go and testify at the Senate. And I'm sure that there were a lot of angry railings at the senators. There was one senator, I can't remember his name, who was particularly irascible and particularly opposed to giving PBS $20 million. Mr. Rogers sat down, was extremely polite. His wife said she could tell that he was nervous by the tone of his voice. But he just said, "You know, I tell children every day, I like you just the way you are." And then he said, "Can I recite the words of a song?" I wish I had written down the words of the song, but it was something like, "What do you do with the mad in you? What do you do when you're mad, 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 when you want to bite someone?" And Mr. Rogers is telling children all over the world, you know, you have a choice. Feelings are mentionable, but they're also manageable. And he finished reciting the words of the songs, just like a 5 to 7 minute presentation. And the senator takes off his glasses and he says, "You just got $20 million. Bringing the power of kindness to the fake power of the Senate. Because here's what I believe. You know, I'm with Gandhi. Gandhi said that there's all these problems in India. There's all these problems all over the world. There's all these problems everywhere. But the truth is that love and kindness always win. So if we can start with love and kindness, if we can start from detaching from our stories about this person is bad and this person is better and I'm better or I'm worse or whatever it is, if we can start looking at our stories, looking at our anxiety, looking at our fears, looking at our dramas that we tell, if we can just feel the feeling that it brings up and know that a feeling is just a movement of energy, and we can sit with that for 90 seconds and then just release and move on and then do it again and again and again and again. It's like rinse and repeat. Over and over and over again. If we can do that and then take that power into the world, that's what's really going to accomplish something. You know, if we continue to try and solve problems with might and with force and with aggression and with hatred and with shaming the shamers, personally, I don't think we're going to get anywhere. I think it has to come from a place of kindness. I think it has to come from a place of great love, great tenderness, and a place of recognition that our power is in the uncertainty that all of this engenders. Because it is a road less traveled, but we get to be pioneers. Sometimes people ask me, you know, what is the purpose of all of this? Why are we going through all of this right now? Why did all of this happen at once? And I don't have a good answer for that. I don't know any more than anybody else does. But I do wonder if perhaps we are being called to give birth to something new. I know also that at times we will be clumsy midwives, right? We might drop the baby occasionally. We might, let me not get into whole midwifery stories. I know a lot of them and I don't need to go there, but we might be clumsy midwives. We might be unskillful midwives as we're giving birth to this new society, to this new generation, to this new vision of a world that truly works for everybody, where everybody is treated justly, a world where people are kind, a world where there is enough food for everybody, a world where people aren't dying of starvation all over the world, a world where the idea of skin color is obsolete. It's like eye color. A world where sexual orientation is also like eye color or shoe size or something as unimportant as that. If we really want to give birth to that, yes, we will be clumsy midwives at first, but with practice, with joining together in communities like this and doing the inner work as well as the outer work, we will soon become skillful midwives and we will give birth to something magnificent. I'm going to close with a quote that I read this week in one of the, 100 or so articles I read about something. I don't even remember what it was in. The writer of this quote's name is Gary Marx. I believe he's one of the Marx brothers. Harpo, Groucho, Zeppo, Carl. No, not Carl. Pinko, no, and Gary, no. Gary Marx is actually a sociologist, but he wrote this quote, and I'm paraphrasing it, and the quote is more of a question. It's like, and it's about uncertainty. He says, how do you know the difference between a fundamentalist and a scholar? And the answer is, a fundamentalist thinks he has all of the answers. A scholar knows he has a lot of questions. May we be scholars. May we be clumsy yet skillful midwives. May we give birth to a new world. And let us pray.